I've been looking forward to this, a chance to talk to Rick Rule. I was going to call Rick a legend, but that ages him too much. But he has been around the resource sector, for 50 years. I mean, focusing on gold, on silver, copper, uranium. And we're going to get his take on all of that today. But he's the president and CEO of Rule Investment Media. You probably know him as the former CEO of Sprott USA. Rick, first of all, we do appreciate you finding time for us.
Well, Michael, thank you. I'm a fan, frankly. I enjoy your work. So thank you for having me on.
Well, it's terrific. You know, one of the things that you get to claim is in this latest cycle, you've been a bull on commodities for, I don't know, I'm going to pick 20 years, you know, and been watching those, that steady, not a straight line, of course, nobody expects a straight line, but overall, you've had this big push up. And I'm just wondering, what's your take on where we're at in that cycle right now?
I'm constructive. I'm constructive on the precious metal side, which I differentiate from the rest of the resource space, because precious metals usually do well when people are concerned about the maintenance of their purchasing power in fiat-denominated instruments. And I think people have reason to be concerned. I think gold is going up for a different reason. I think that gold is going up because central banks are looking for a medium of exchange outside the U.S. dollar. And if you overlay then retail buying, which I think will begin to come in as a consequence of the deterioration of the purchasing power, in particular the U.S. dollar, I think gold would do quite well. With regards to industrial materials, the story is very different. Mike, it's basically the ascent of humankind. We've done a great job in the last 40 years lifting the poorest of the poor, the bottom third of humanity, up from dire poverty and making them just plain poor, which is a wonderful thing. But we have a big job left ahead of us. We have 1 billion people on Earth with no access to primary electricity. Another 2 billion people on Earth that have access to intermittent or unaffordable energy. And those people want to live like you and I do. When the bottom third of humanity gets more money, which they are getting, the stuff that has utility to them is stuff that's made of stuff. When you get more money, you buy your grandchild some little trinket from Apple. Or you buy a service. But when a very poor person gets more money, they increase the calorie count in their house. They change their mode of transportation from barefoot. They replace a thatch roof with a steel roof. They replace mud wattle with cement. The fact is that increases in the living standards of the bottom third of humanity are almost all material. And that's good for natural resources. Yeah. I'm not saying that we won't have a recession in the next 5 years that depresses prices. I'm not saying we will. I'm not smart enough. I'm not an economist. I'm a credit guy. But I'm very bullish around industrial commodities simply because of the ascent of man. And I'm particularly bullish. I continue to be particularly bullish about fossil fuels, which the big thinkers, of course, don't like, but the market does.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me come back. You got covered a lot of ground there, thankfully. Let me come back to gold for a second here. That we have one of the things I've always said is you get a bull market in gold when it's a bull market in all currencies. We are experiencing that right now. And are you saying that's driven mainly by the central banks? So when things like the U.S. or the Western allies sort of politicized, the SWIFT account or confiscated bank accounts, this is the outcome of that, or at least partial outcome of that.
Absolutely. From the data I've seen, Western retail buyers are selling the ETFs, which is to say there's dishoarding by individual investors around gold. The purchases, from what the market looks like to me, are largely central banks. Central banks that probably in a different place and time would have preferred the yield on U.S. Treasury securities. But the weaponization of the U.S. dollar, the colonization of the SWIFT banking system, the confiscation of Russia's treasury assets has given a whole bunch of countries who are nervous about the extraterritorial imposition of American will, it has them feeling the need to own a medium of exchange that isn't either their own currencies, which they know to be weak, or our currency, which they're afraid to hold.
It was kind of interesting. Last week, we had him on this week too, but Rob Levy with us. But Rob Levy's Border Gold, and he's the head of that. But he told us an interesting story. He said, as the prices went up to these highs, and then, you know, higher in Canadian dollar terms, obviously, but a high, all-time high in the U.S. dollars, he actually was seeing retail selling. So it's kind of interesting. I mean, is that the old, the retail sells at the top and, or buys at the top and, you know, whatever it is, but it looks like the timing is kind of peculiar.
Certainly as a large shareholder in Sprott and a beneficiary, an indirect beneficiary of their physical trusts, I watch the ETF flows very closely. They're competitors of ours. And there has been really surprisingly strong disintermediation, a fancy word for selling, around those physical ETF products. So it's pretty obvious to me that while the underlying trend in the gold price is positive, investor sentiment is still bad. And if you really want to get excited, Mike, let me share a little fact with you. The market share of precious metals and precious metals related investments in the U.S. market relative to other classes of savings and investment assets is less than 0.5%, which is to say that less than 0.5% of U.S. savings and investment assets are denominated in precious metals. The four-decade mean market share is 2%. If precious metals were to revert to mean, which, by the way, I think they will, demand for this asset class quadruples. To me, that's incredibly bullish.
Yeah. Here's an interesting side that I wish I'd mentioned up front, but I just mentioned the US dollar, a high there, high in Canadian dollars. I mean, I also want people to imagine the high it's made in Venezuelan Bolivar, right. The high it's right. made in the Brazilian real. I mean, we have a tendency, yes, it's natural, but to focus on, say, the US and Canada and then the West, maybe a little bit broader. But my gosh, I've counted about 150 currencies who have hit the tank, you know, to a greater and lesser degree. I mean, I don't want to own the rupee either, and I don't want to own anything in Pakistan. But I think Westerners sort of forget the decimation of the purchasing power of the vast majority of countries in this world. And I mean, as I say, put up a chart of gold in those currencies, and it's like a straight up line.
You make a very good point. Those people who have denominated their life in U.S. dollars have been a fairly pampered lot. There has been deterioration of your U.S. dollar purchasing power, but complaining about it is pretty disingenuous if you compare yourself against a peso holder or a rupee holder, or in fact, even a euro holder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember when the euro, I called it the easiest short of my life was the euro at about 154.
Right.
I just don't believe that it's structured properly, let alone some of the other problems that are now more apparent, you know, today. But that also begs a few questions for me about silver. A lot of times they're linked, you know, gold, silver ratio, all of that stuff. Should we expect that close a correlation? I mean, what's your take on silver these days?
I have a difficult time understanding the utility of the gold-silver ratio because I think it's a measure of relative scarcity without any discussion of utility. It certainly helps sell people silver. And so I guess as a commission generator for a bullion dealer, it's a wonderful thing to refer to. In my own experience, precious metals narratives, a precious metals bull market is always led by gold because the initial motivator is always fear. In my experience, with the exception of the mini market that we had in the year 2000, silver follows gold. I guess because of its lower unit cost, when it starts to move, it moves further and faster. But in my experience watching bull markets, going back to 1970, frankly, the precious metals bull market is always led by gold, and then silver is a mid-cycle and light cycle participant, albeit a much more dramatic participant when it catches fire. Mike, I wish I could tell you why that is, but I don't know.
Well, it also, the question, maybe the most often asked question I've gotten, there's a few always, as you know, you speak all over North America, you get questions, is about the non-performance of gold stocks, you know, because people sit there and they watch, hey, you know, especially as I say in Canadian dollars, but it could be in euro, hey, look at the performance of this, of that metal, you know, and it's been pretty consistent. It's been, you know, a compound rate, it's been excellent. But my point is, how come the gold stocks are still languishing, whatever it is, a 4 or 5 year low?
Well, this is going to get us a lot of hate, Mike, so let's do it.
I'm no stranger to that, Rick. I'll tell you.
I think investors' perceptions around gold were really shaped in the decade of the 1970s. when the gold price didn't move up, it exploded. It went from $35 to $850. And the stocks that performed the best in that decade were the stocks that were leveraged to the gold price. So investors for 70 years have regarded gold stocks as in effect, warrants on gold, leverage warrants on gold. Now, ironically, the stocks that exhibit the best leverage are the most marginal. If you have skinny margins and the gold price goes up, your margins expand faster than a more prudently run company. So the investors for 70 years have really been asking the gold industry to exhibit leverage and marginality. And the gold mining industry became extremely marginal. It became a lousy business. We got, as investors, what we asked for, and we should have asked for good businesses. If you go back to the decade 2000 to 2010, when the gold price moved from like $250 to like $1,900, $1,950, better than a sevenfold increase, the free cash flow per share of the XAU fell. The industry exhibited real skill to generate negative cash flow growth when the underlying commodity that they produce went up sevenfold. And of course, the value proposition of the junior market is worse. If you added every junior mining company in the world together into one company, Junior Explorco, in a very good year, that company would lose $2 billion. In a bad year, it would lose $10 billion. So investors have begun to ask themselves, what would you pay for this company? Should you pay six times losses? Nine times losses? What that grim statistic, or those two grim statistics, fail to note, which is useful in this market, is that institutional investors and retail investors are beginning to hold the mining companies to a higher standard. And the managers that presided over that monumental degradation in value have been allowed to pursue other employment opportunities. They aren't polluting our sector particularly. And with regards to the juniors, while 90% of the listings are probably flotsam and jetsam, you know, pure dross, the performance by perhaps 5% of the listed companies is so extraordinary that they add legitimacy and sometimes luster to a sector that loses between $2 and $10 billion a year. My point is, Mike, if you invest in the sector over a decade or two, you're going to go broke. You need to invest in companies, a small subset in the company of the companies. If you're not prepared to do the work, you need to look at some other investment venue for yourself.
I'm wondering, sitting here listening, and I make so many good points, but if I found a correlation between the price of gold movement, I put that chart up, but then put other charts of individual stocks against it, and I found that there was a really strong correlation, you know, when they go up. Should that be maybe my starting point? Or I guess my starting point may be cash flow, and are they broke?
Yeah, but I really think your starting point is a gold investor, because the upside takes care of itself once a decade.
Yeah.
The starting point ought to be thinking about how you limit your downside. For most investors, particularly most Vancouver investors, they're too speculative. And too often the technique has got a hunch, bet a bunch, which has been proven not to work. For most investors, because in a real true gold equities bull market, the sector can give you 300% returns. For most investors, minimizing downside should be their foremost concern, not maximizing upside. In fact, not even buying the XAU, but trying to buy the five or six best companies in the XAU, maybe accepting a marginally lower return in return for taking 80 or 85% of the company risk out of the sector. The idea that you want to generate alpha relative to the sector, which I love to do, involves taking more risk, enduring more volatility, and doing lots and lots and lots of work. I ask speculators who take my mining classroom courses, which are free, by the way, to own a number of speculative positions that corresponds exactly with the number of hours per month they're willing to work following their companies. Too many investors own 60 companies, and they're willing to work 2 hours a month. And they think that 2 hours should include things like watching videos like this, not specific stuff about their stocks. And that's really problematic.
Well, I would love to put that and just post it permanently because, you know, too many people just aren't willing to do the work. We're intellectually lazy. I could give a lot of other areas, politics, but yeah, I just think your point's well taken. Is it fair to ask you, do you have a couple of favorites you can share with us? And I'm talking in turn. Now, we're not making recommendations. We don't know individual circumstances. That's impossible. But, you know, a couple of companies that you sort of explored and thought, hey, they're worth more exploration, or they're worth more of my attention because they're starting to meet these criteria of being well run, you know, hopefully profitable, you know, take advantage of a rise in gold prices.
Yeah, I can talk about companies now. I'm not regulated anymore. So I have commercial freedom of speech, which is odd. As you suggest, these aren't investment recommendations. They're just, let's call them educational topics. Most people are underrepresented at the top end of the quality trail. Franco-Nevada very recently lost the Cobre Panama royalty, at least temporarily. And an asset that was 15 or 16% of net asset value caused them to lose 42% of their market capitalization. This is fairly simple arithmetic. You started with a dollar bill. Somebody took away 15 cents of it, so you have 85 cents left, but it sold off to 62 cents. 85 cents for 62 cents is a pretty good deal. Another name local to Vancouver would be Wheaton Precious. I know that these aren't aggressive names, but I'm deliberately starting with non-aggressive names because I'd like your listeners to invest before they speculate.
Yeah, great point.
Having said that, that's not what people are going to do. So let's give you another interesting special situation, one in your town, Equinox Gold. Of course, the chairman has been a friend of mine for 45 years, Ross Beatty. Disclosure of conflicts of interest. I'm not merely long. I'm way long. The stock sold off 55, 60% for three reasons. First of all, it was too expensive to begin with. but secondly, they deferred sustaining capital investments in two of their operations, which came back to bite them. They've addressed that. But most importantly, of course, they were building a $1 billion deposit in Northern Ontario. And the industry's recent experience in the Canadian Shield, both on the Ontario side and the Quebec side of the border, with new builds has been atrocious. Côté Lake, 2 years late, almost triple budget, as an example. And the industry, I think, was betting that Equinox would be the latest in a string of companies that failed in the Abitibi. Instead, Equinox delivered on time, on budget. They're going to need to shake this mill out. It's going to take 5 months or 6 months to see if this new mining and milling operation achieves nameplate capacity. If it does, and I believe it will, I've watched Ross Beatty teams build mines for 30 years now. I believe it will. At today's gold price, the stock will double if they deliver nameplate capacity. So, you know, I think that's an interesting choice.
I've got to give a shout out, by the way, digress for a sec, to Randy Smallwood, you know, who's the head of Wheaton Precious. That guy, I mean, I do a lot. I've committed on Special Olympics. Randy and his company do a spectacular job supporting Special Olympics. Sorry, I had to get that in there because they don't get enough credit. And Randy's an excellent CEO, but also their company.
And they're able to support the community while keeping their general and administrative expense, which that support comes out of, very low by industry standards. Randy is an absolutely top quality executive in terms of keeping control of expenditures with the cash running in and not spending all the G&A or giving all the options to himself, but in fact, spreading it through the whole staff and laterally to the community, and not just the community that he resides in, Vancouver. They are very active supporting community projects everywhere in the world that they derive revenue. He's just a superb human being.
Let me come, because you were with Sprott. Were you at Sprott when they started, or you know, just in party to, they were going to go into uranium? Because that's been another favorite of Money Talks. You know, we've been recommending heavily uranium. I'm just wondering if you were there when they started the Sprott Uranium Fund.
With all undue humility, I think I was the one who pushed uranium the hardest within Sprott. Now, in truth, the then CEO of Sprott, Peter Grosskopf, was the one who talked the Lundins into launching Uranium Participation Corp. Which is the vehicle that Sprott bought to turn into the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. So there was uranium in the Sprott DNA for a fairly long time. I was a major beneficiary of the uranium bull market in the period 2000 to 2008. And when uranium sold off so aggressively post-Fukushima, I could taste the ability to enjoy that comeback. Mercifully for me, the team that we had at Sprott, led by John Champaglia, was able, after a 1.5 year courtship, to get control first of Uranium Participation Corp, which they renamed the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, and then the North Shore Uranium ETF. So I think it's fair to say that as a board member and then the largest shareholder, I was a particular advocate of Sprott's move in uranium. The team, since I have retired, has done an absolutely superb job managing those products and also talking to the uranium constituency around the world.
Let me talk a little bit more about that, because there's a couple things. Is one, we've had that huge rise and I think a very normal sort of pullback to some degree on the price of uranium. It's a different market now. I think there's wider acceptance that we are going to expand our we are expanding our nuclear facilities. They're going to need uranium. And I think every week I post something about somebody else, including Japan. You know, you mentioned Fukushima, including Japan doing it, but South Korea. I mean, the list is a long one. I'm happy that Canada looks like it's going to take at least some advantage of our expertise, you know, and some of the projects we've got going here. But where do you see now? Is this a case where investors should buy the dip, sit back to see where it goes? You know, and I'm talking not trading. I'm talking, investment.
Mike, it depends on the investor. From a speculator's point of view, and by the way, I'm both, the easy money's been made. You make money, the easy money in commodities, by buying them when they're hated. You buy uranium in 2022 when nobody wants it, when people are bored by it or afraid of it. If you dial your mind back to 2022, the industry was selling the stuff for $20 a pound, and it was costing the industry fully loaded, including tax and royalty, and including cost of capital, was costing the industry $60 a pound to make the stuff. So you make it for 60, you sell it for 20, you lose $40 a pound. Being dumb miners, you try and make it up on volume. On the face of it, investors look at that and say, why would you own an industry in liquidation? The answer to that is because uranium is critical to the ascent of humankind. Even in societies that believe themselves rich enough not to need uranium, like the United States, it's 14% of total electrical generation and 20% of baseload generation. That means that over 5 years, if the price of uranium doesn't go high enough that it covers the industry cost of capital, the lights go out. So you had to ask yourself in 2022, what was most likely to happen? Would uranium clear 60 or would the lights go out? I decided it was likely that the price went up. That move from 20 to 100, from hated to at least tolerated, is where the easy money has been made. That's over. I think the sure money, though, Mike, is ahead of us. The reason I say that is that the uranium market, unlike any other commodity market that I know of in the world, is progressing from a spot market, to a term market. And what the term market does is it locks in prices and volumes for periods of time as long as 15 years. That makes credit facilities to build uranium mines cheaper. Because the lender knows, at least for some portion of the production, what they're going to get paid for the production and what their margins are going to be. It means that lazy securities analysts like Rick Rule don't have to trouble themselves too much with uranium price forecasts, but rather pay attention to the pricing guidelines in contracts. There's no other commodity that I know of in the world where producers and consumers can lock in prices and volumes in a framework for as long as 15 years with some pricing certainty. And that is, over the next 5 years, I think, going to change the way uranium stocks are valued in a positive way.
Yeah. I don't want to run out of time without, I mean, that's a wonderful explanation, and I don't hear it often enough. The fact that now we're going to be able to extend 10, 15 year contracts. So I know what my power generation is going to cost. I'm a producer. I can bend into that. I just think it's a point I'm not hearing often enough, Rick, and I'm glad you made it here. Let me throw out a couple more because I don't want to run out of time, but here's a commodity that had a big price drop. It had the run-ups, had a price drop. Your take on lithium.
Yeah, I mean, you have to decide if it had a price drop and over what period of time. The price of lithium was up sixfold, and now it's fallen by 70%. So depending on your time frame, it's either up or down. When lithium was hot as an investment, it was stupidly hot, very much like uranium at the top of the last bull market. You had probably 200 companies worldwide that 5 years ago couldn't spell lithium, but were suddenly lithium experts. And of course, we weren't ever short of elemental lithium. The demand for lithium chemical products expanded so fast that we couldn't debottleneck the processing facilities fast enough to supply the demand. We went looking for lithium with a lot of money, and we were spectacularly successful. We didn't just find lithium. We found lots and lots and lots of lithium. Meanwhile, various people, the Chinese, but Albemarle, SQM, were building lithium processing capacity like mad too. So when demand overwhelmed supply, what happened was pretty easy to figure out. It's going to take us 3 or 4 years to digest the lithium discoveries that we've made and rationalize the deposits. Between those deposits that are going to be at the bottom, well, at the best quartile with regards to all-in sustaining costs, and at the top quartile with regards to return on capital employed, that process, that shakeout, is going to really, really anger speculators who only thought about the future of electric vehicles, nothing about the economics of the companies that they've invested in. And my suspicion is that by 2027 or sometime like that, lithium is going to be absolutely hated. The speculators who were burned are going to regard lithium as a four-letter word. You know, there's no hate as intense as the hate of a scorned lover. Yeah. And there are probably 500,000 scorned lovers around lithium. And when that happens, I'm going to have my shopping list ready. Mm-hmm. You know, when it has no bid, when it has no friends, I'm going to be a friendly bidder. But I don't think it's going to happen for 3 or 4 years. We have to digest an awful lot of discoveries.
And allow me to just, I feel like Barbara Walters here. I'm just peppering you with these questions this way. But, you know, you mentioned EVs, but that whole renewable revolution. I mean, copper is going to be in demand. I mean, everything I read from good analysts are telling me, you know, you just can't do that side without a heck of a lot more copper that's out there. So I've sort of been this long-term bull since 2020. You know, a patient long-term bull, because I don't think we're in the story yet. But I think I better get the take from someone who's been in that business 50 years. Well,
I love the copper business because in my heart of hearts, I love great big deposits. You know, I like $10 billion plus in situ valuations. And there's any number of copper mines in the world that make $1 million a day. I like copper, first of all, because it's a great business. I like it, too, because it's essential to the ascent of humankind. We said at the onset of this interview that there's 1 billion people on Earth with no access to primary electricity. To get them that electricity, we need copper. And for them to use it, they need copper. The story isn't just electric vehicles or data centers.
Yes.
The story is the ascent of humankind, which is a big tons story. Meanwhile, the industry will tell you.
And again, let me also, you know, the overlay for some of this, and we've seen this in the last couple of years, but it's geopolitical risk. How do you factor that in? Do you just, I'm staying clear of those guys, you know what I mean? Or you're saying that, you know, that's an X because, as you said, you're managing risk along the way. So how do you factor in geopolitical risk?
We'll generate some more hate here. geopolitical risk is inherent in mining. The odd fact is, Mike, that people who look like you and I, which is to say old white guys, seem not to be concerned about political risk that's done to us by white guys in English according to the rule of law in a legislature. Mm-hmm. And we tend to be very concerned when the potential theft occurs in places like Africa or Asia or Latin America, where we're unaware of the nature of the risk. Now, I personally equate a campaign contribution with a bribe. I don't think it matters particularly to me whether my assets get stolen in California or Congo. And I think that every jurisdiction in the world is a bad jurisdiction. Mm. The question becomes, how much do I have to pay for the risk that I'm willing to assume? It would be very difficult for somebody to talk me into investing in BC, except in territories controlled by the Tahltan and Nishka, who can provide political cover for me from the NDP. Most people in BC don't think it's a particularly risky jurisdiction. I've been treated much better in Chile, Congo, Sudan, until recently, Russia. So political risk is an interesting topic for me. I would much rather have a great deposit in what is perceived to be a lousy jurisdiction than a lousy deposit in what's perceived to be a good jurisdiction. I'm much more willing to take political risk than I am technical risk, particularly around copper. I want a big deposit. I want it to be in the best cost quartile, and I want it to be in the best return on capital employed quartile. I'm less fussy about the jurisdiction, as I say, because I believe them all to be bad.
Rick, let's finish it. Just tell me a little bit about, as you said, you offer free seminars on the mining side of things. Tell me a little bit more about where I can get a hold of that, because we both certainly agree that education is how you reduce risk. You start with that. So tell me a little bit more about that.
We do a couple things that your audience might be interested in. If they like the way I think around natural resources, they can personalize it. If they go to ruralinvestmentmedia.com, you can list your natural resource stocks and I'll personally rank them 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst. This is free, no obligation. If you want to know how I think and why I think, go to the Rural Classroom. There's 200 hours of instructional programming there. It's all completely free. If you want to pay me, I'll take your money. Once every 90 days, I put on a deep dive boot camp. We'll take one topic. It might be uranium. It might be silver. We have one coming up on exploration and prospect generation. These are eight and a half hour long intense days. You have access to the recordings for 12 months. You'll need that because we give you more information in 8 hours than you can absorb. Yeah. It's $99 to attend. It's in the comfort of your own home. There's a gold-plated money-back guarantee. If you attend the boot camp, don't think you got your money's worth, email me. I'll give you the money back. My granddaddy product is the Natural Resources Investment Symposium. We put it on in Vancouver for 20-something years. During COVID, we had to move it to Florida. The ArriveCan app and my customer base would have generated border incidents. So we had to move it to Florida. I think simply this is the finest investment symposium in the natural resource business. Whether you attend live in Boca Raton, July 7 through 11, or live stream from the comfort of your own home, again, gold-plated money-back guarantee. If you feel for any reason that we didn't deliver content that was worth your subscription price, email me. Money's yours.
Well, we're going to put all of that up again. We'll print that out, as I'm saying, besides the interview, of course, so people can see it. They didn't have to memorize it. But I just wanted to make people aware of the kinds of things that you're doing. And in the meantime, one of the things I'm glad you're doing is doing interviews like this. Rick, I really appreciate you finding time. And as I say, great contribution to our overall knowledge base.
Mike, it's an honor to do it. When I was a young man, I benefited a lot from a lot of mentors. And to the extent that I don't try to give knowledge back, it would dishonor the people who were responsible for my success. Mm-hmm. So thank you for the venue to do precisely that.
Great stuff.